Fifth case, U.S. versus Stacy Harden, 13-1323. And Mr. Floor.
I thought Merrill was going to give the opening. Wasn't Merrill? I guess not.
I got that right, Mr. Floor?
Yes, Floor, yeah.
Floor, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. I am Andrews Floor, here on behalf of Stacy Lee Harden. The Supreme Court has said that Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution forbids congressional attempts to transfer jurisdiction to non-Article 3 tribunals for the purpose of emasculating constitutional courts. Mr. Harden suffered just such an illicit transferal when the power to accept his guilty plea was given to a magistrate judge.
But here given by an Article 3 judge, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court, yes, granted the magistrate that power.
And so you contend, since this wasn't done on a report and recommendation, that Harden didn't have a chance to object to the taking of the plea by the magistrate judge?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What would Harden have objected to about the colloquy or the process before the magistrate judge? What was wrong, other than, I understand your Article 3 argument, but how was it not done correctly?
There was no flaw in the conducting of the Rule 11 colloquy. As far as we know, Judge Wilkerson did a perfect job on that front. The point is just that, as a constitutional matter, he had no power to accept it.
But it's sort of just a piece of paper at that point. Instead of sending it over as an accepted plea, it's sent over as an R&R, and the district judge looks at it, and there's no objection filed. Accepts.
Yes, Your Honor, but
that seems pretty technical.
The decision as to whether or not to accept the guilty plea, though, is not really sort of as purely ministerial as some other courts have made it seem. The accepting judge must make sure that it's on a sufficient factual basis and that it's knowing and voluntary. That sort of final decision-making power is reserved by the Constitution, Article 3.
And your brief at several points says that the magistrate judge entered judgment on the plea, right?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
But what I'm looking at is the judgment itself, the judgment in a criminal case that is entered by Judge Herndon, the district judge. And I don't see anything on the docket prior to this judgment that reflects the entry of a judgment by the magistrate judge.
Why? Your Honor, no report and recommendation was filed by the magistrate judge in this case, so the district judge had no opportunity to either accept or reject based on that.
Right, but the document itself, judgment in a criminal case, says the defendant is adjudicated guilty of these offenses, signed by Judge Herndon. That seems to be the first entry of judgment in this case.
I mean, it may well have been Judge Herndon who signed that final order, but it was At the termination of the Rule 11 colloquy by Magistrate Judge Wilkerson, the plea was accepted. So there was no opportunity for Judge Herndon to sort of properly review any kind of report or anything like that from the magistrate judge so that he could make his determination.
If there one of the things that troubles me, Mr. Floor, is there was no effort to withdraw the plea. There was no... As far as Judge Herndon was concerned, there was no issue as to the plea. If there had been an effort, and, for example, the government had responded with an argument, well, you've got to show just and fair cause, for example, then the issue might have been teed up.
Your Honor, the problem with relying on defendants to object to any problems that might arise, or any problems they might have with the magistrates conducting of the colloquy, is that they're not really in a position, nor are they properly incentivized, to object if their plea isn't knowing, voluntary, and on a sufficient factual basis.
Isn't that the same thing that one would do to a report and recommendation? You would have to object to it, wouldn't you?
So
it's the same defendant that would be in that position.
With the report and recommendation, the district judge at that point would have the power to decide, even in the absence of objection, whether they needed more information or whether they wanted to reconduct the colloquy themselves if they wanted. They would have that power to decide at that point, even absent objection by the defendant.
And Judge Hearn didn't have that authority in this instance?
He
sent it to the magistrate judge to conduct that proceeding.
To conduct the proceeding, yes.
How was Judge Herndon precluded from, say, reconsidering that or exploring the adequacy of it?
Because there was no report and recommendation in this case. It wasn't sort of presented to him properly for him to have that opportunity to review the matter.
But guilt wasn't adjudicated until the sentence was imposed. Until that time, the judgment is actually entered of record.
I mean, it's true that as sort of an almost a sort of informal or implicit matter, Judge Herndon may have sort of implicitly, quote unquote, accepted the plea at that point. But the Constitution doesn't provide for that kind of implicit acceptance any more than it does allow for juries to implicitly enter a verdict of guilty if it does go to trial. I see I'm running into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so if I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
I have a question for you.
Certainly.
Assuming that there was a potential procedural error, even one that was of constitutional magnitude, how does that make the plea or the plea agreement unknowing or involuntary? What's the connection?
It doesn't make it unknowing or involuntary, Your Honor. It's just purely that it's a violation of the constitutional separation of powers to make that determination. That final determination.
Right, well, wouldn't the appellate waiver be valid then? As long as the plea isn't unknowing or involuntary, then the defendant could effectively waive his right to appeal.
No, Your Honor, the appeal, the plea is what's being challenged here. We're saying that it was unconstitutionally accepted and hence is invalid. Hence, any appeal waiver that was part of that plea agreement is likewise invalid.
Could we reverse here without creating a circuit split with the Second, Fourth, and Tenth Circuits?
No, Your Honor. There would be a circuit split. Those circuits have explicitly held that magistrates can accept guilty pleas.
Okay. And has any circuit come out the other way?
No, those circuits have come out the way you describe. Other circuits have failed to make the distinction between conducting a colloquy and accepting the plea.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Simonson?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Obviously, an issue in this case is whether or not there's a structural constitutional violation here, and it's certainly the government's position that there is not one, and that is based on the existing case law where the circuits that you mentioned previously have dealt with actual acceptance of guilty pleas, as well as the guidance followed by all those courts given by the Supreme Court in United States versus Perez. There they talked about voir dire, but the Fourth Circuit, Eleventh Circuit, and Tenth Circuit, who have discussed the acceptance of pleas by magistrates, have used the guidance by Perez.
Do you think a defendant could consent to a magistrate judge conducting the felony trial?
I think that, first of all, the question would be, is that a potential structural problem?
And is I think it, first of all, is it statutorily permissible? Second, is it constitutionally permissible?
I think the first thing you have to look at is it's specified in the Federal Magistrates Act. As the analysis that you do here is, number one, is it listed in there? If it's not, is it an additional duty that is similar to the duties that are listed? I think you're looking at a more difficult situation there or scenario there than you have in this case.
I didn't hear an answer to that question. Would it be permissible or not?
I do not think it would be permissible.
Okay, why is since the result, an adjudication of guilt, is the same, why is this different?
I think we're looking at the actual function that happens at the acceptance of a plea. And what you have here, as described by a number of the cases, is a fairly mechanical decision on whether or not the defendant is knowing involuntarily pleading guilty.
It's usually pretty easy, but it presents difficult questions from time to time, right? About competence. Could the magistrate judge decide the defendant's competence to stand trial and to enter a plea?
Could
the magistrate judge enter a final decision that is reviewable only kind of under on a deferential standard of review as to whether the defendant is competent to stand trial or to enter a plea?
Well, I don't know specifically the answer to that. I think that the analysis...
If we agree with you, wouldn't that follow?
I believe so.
Let me ask you, could the magistrate judge accept a plea that's entered under Rule 11C1C? It's binding as to sentencing?
Well, I think, number one, I think consent would be extremely important.
We're assuming consent.
Mm-hmm.
Could the magistrate judge enter an order, state on the record, I'm accepting your 11C1C plea?
I think that could happen, Your Honor, because
therefore binding the district judge's discretion with respect to sentencing.
Well, I think that the district judge would still potentially have the ability to be able to review that.
Under what standard?
If they move to withdraw the plea agreement, Your Honor.
What if the district judge doesn't like it?
Doesn't like
the binding agreement with respect to his sentencing?
Well, I think the district court judge...
The plea has been accepted, right?
Well, in this case, potentially the plea has been accepted, but that doesn't mean that the parties can't move to withdraw the plea, which goes to the district court.
That's always going to be the case, but until the district judge has accepted a plea,
mm-hmm.
the defendant can just withdraw at will, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what's different here is that the magistrate judge accepted the plea and defendant no longer had the right to withdraw at will. Now, he didn't try, and that's a problem.
Right.
But if he had tried, then we would face this issue about what standard would have to be applied, correct?
Yes. And I don't exactly know the answer. I think what the courts seem to be concerned about and the Supreme Court seems to be concerned about is as long as the district court judge has some ability to review what has taken place by the magistrate. If there is an instance where that is completely taken away, certainly based on the case law that we've seen in the various circuits that discuss the issue as well as the Supreme Court, that certainly would raise the level of concern.
So I think where your logic leads, correct me if I'm wrong, is that a magistrate judge could not, even with the defendant's consent, accept an 11C1C plea because that would bind the district judge's discretion as to sentencing, but could enter and accept a plea under A or B.
I think if you completely take away any reviewability or any discretion whatsoever by the district court, you certainly get into a much more problematic scenario, which our argument certainly sounds like a yes. Certainly isn't the case that we have in front of us here today, Your Honor.
No, but the question is where your logic leads us. And I'm frankly pretty concerned about it. Because parsing this very vague residual power under 636 to say with consent under you can accept a plea under A and B but not C. That's a matter of statutory construction. We're way away from the text at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and we've got a statute that's very finely crafted in terms of what you can do with consent and what you can do without consent. And we're talking about a major step here.
Rule 59.
Mm-hmm. And 636.
Your Honor, I will say, and I would like to state the government's position here is that we believe that In this particular case, we don't get to that, because the first question is this a structural constitutional problem where the magistrate is accepting a plea? And again, we believe that the answer is no, and that's based on the circuits. Every circuit out there that has discussed this particular issue has said that there is no structural constitutional problem. Again, that's the Fourth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, and the 10th Circuit. And in addition, the Supreme Court has said that in Peretz.
While you're listing those, what other districts in this circuit used the process that was used in this case?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. And I do know, I think I noted in my brief, that our district court, I believe after this court came out in U.S. versus Moore.
You're using R&R now, right?
Yes.
Why did the district change? Do you know?
I speculate that it was in response to this court's decision and discussion in U.S. versus Moore, a 2013 case where there was some discussion about Rule 59. I can't speak for them, but that's my basic understanding, where this court said there's some unfinished answers on Rule 59. But again, in this case, it's our argument that we never get to Rule 59, because once there's no structural problem, the waiver in the plea agreement kicks in. It is, we believe, valid. It has not been challenged as to whether it's knowing and voluntary. So we believe, obviously, if there's a structural problem here, then there could be problems with the plea agreement. But we believe that there is no structural issue, so the plea agreement is then valid, and the waiver, therefore, is valid. So
there's a separate waiver here, too, isn't there, to the taking of the plea by the magistrate judge? Isn't that done separate from the plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the general concept of waiver applies here, because the defendant knowingly consented, and as we know, waiver is the intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right, and the defendant affirmatively consented and knowingly waived that. To the extent that Rule 59, this court believes that it gets even to Rule 59, Rule 59 provides for how the defendant is supposed to follow that as well, and says how they have to go about objecting, and if they do not object, the waiver also applies there too. But we believe that based on the fact that there is no structural issue here, and there's then no challenge to knowing involuntary plea, that the waiver in the plea applies, and the remaining matters, including the Federal Magistrates Act as well as Rule 59, that those arguments are waived.
I see no other questions. Hear no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Ms. Merrill.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. All errors that affect the framework within the trial proceeds are structural. These errors implicate the basic protections and ultimately render criminal trial unfair and unreliable for determining guilt or innocence, because it calls into question the framework in which the defendant was judged. The error is not harmless.
So why is it okay for a magistrate to conduct a misdemeanor trial and send somebody to prison?
A misdemeanor is under a year and has been treated differently in many different ways. You can still vote if you are convicted of a misdemeanor, but a felony, the penalties are much greater.
But why is that a constitutional difference with respect to the judicial officers in question?
Here, the Article III judges, the court has previously held that Article III judges can only preside over misdemeanor trials and plea colloquies in felony trials. The reasoning here is that the importance of a felony trial is to be left for an Article III judge to ultimately decide. Additionally, Mr. Harding couldn't even consent to a magistrate judge usurping the powers that he ultimately simply never had in the first place, because doing so would upset the essential separation of powers set out in the Constitution. The defendant cannot consent to a magistrate judge assuming duties that he structurally does not have. For example, he cannot consent to a magistrate judge conducting a felony trial. This applies to the magistrate judge accepting the plea. Additionally, the determination of guilt is the central purpose of a criminal trial, and the effect of a magistrate judge exercising non-existent authority to adjudicate guilt violates this basic protection afforded by the Constitution. Congress avoided these concerns by impinging on Article III powers by making sure that the district court retained these powers. But in the case currently before this court, the magistrate judge, in exercising these powers, normally vested in Article III courts, the ability to adjudicate guilt in a felony court. This authority lies at the heart of the powers reserved for Article III courts.
Let me ask you this question. We know in Peretz that the Supreme Court said it was all right for a magistrate judge with consent to conduct voir dire in a jury trial. But in that situation, a judge can rule against the defendant. The defendant could make an objection that some juror was not suited to this jury, and the district judge could say, I disagree with you, I'm going to put that juror on the jury regardless of what you want. But in this case, when we're talking about taking a plea, the judge can't do anything that the defendant doesn't want to do. The judge can only preside over the defendant's wish to plead guilty. And so how could it be that in a situation where a magistrate judge is telling a defendant they can't do something that they want to do, and here a magistrate judge is only approving what the defendant wants to do, how could that offend the Constitution?
Consent doesn't cure the structural error in this case. And so even though
It did in Peretz, right?
But the reasoning in Peretz was that the district court retained supervisory power over the magistrate judge. And here, without the report and recommendation, we don't have that same sort of supervisory power that existed in Peretz.
You don't think that if Judge Herndon had been troubled by what he got, he didn't have the power to step in and do something here?
I think he didn't have a good opportunity to review what had happened before the magistrate judge because there was no report and recommendation.
And no objection. And no objection, right?
And yeah, and my problem with that is that the adjudication of guilt does not happen here until the district judge makes that adjudication. So it seems to me he does have the opportunity to step in and decide to reject this.
The court has previously held, though, that a report and recommendation was essential to making sure that there wasn't a violation of separation of three powers. Specifically, Red Atz centered on the importance that the report and recommendation allowed and gave that district court judge the supervisory power. So placing that burden on the defendant to say, hey, you know, I'm not sure what happened, is concerning.
Let me ask about the consequences of the acceptance of the plea here. Obviously, there's no sentence imposed until later, and nobody's suggesting yet that the magistrate judge has the power to make that decision, even with consent, although the logic may carry it in that direction. But as I look at this, essentially two things happen when the plea is accepted by whichever judicial officer is involved. One is that the defendant no longer has an absolute right to back out. You agree with that?
Yes.
Second is that may have some significant practical consequences under the Bail Reform Act. The standard changes between from pretrial to convicted. If you're pending sentencing, and after a guilty plea has been accepted, you are pending sentencing, then the burdens shift and it becomes more difficult to be released. It seems to me those are that's the consequence as to the practical consequence that we're talking about here.
Absolutely, and I think aside from it just being a practical consequence, the final authority to accept a plea is clearly available, or retained, the Constitution retains that power for Article III judges, and to upset that could lead to a felony trial being conducted by a magistrate judge. And I think since the final adjudication of the plea ultimately has the same effect, the fact that a felony trial cannot be conducted by a magistrate judge indicates that nor should the adjudication of a guilty plea.
You're from the University of Illinois?
Yes.
As Mr. Flores?
Yes.
I think the university should be very proud of both of you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're here.
Thank you.
And thank you to all counsel and counsel-to-be. We'll